walked into his house to find that someone had broken his windows and stolen his television. But he didn't let himself get too far down. Immediately, he tried to turn the situation around. "Look," he said, "let's try to salvage something out of this. Let's go into business together. Let's form a new company. I'll support you. And you guys write whatever games you want, and I'll handle selling them. We'll split everything 50-50, and I won't take any legal action against you." The offer caught them by surprise. They had assumed Big Al was going to sue them, not finance their business. Now there was a new golden opportunity. All they wanted to do was have their own business, and they had no interest in dealing with the hassles of taxes and distribution. If Al was going to handle that stuff, what the hell? They agreed. But when Al returned to the soft disk office, he walked into a mutiny. The entire company had gathered to demand an explanation. "Carmack and Romero came back from lunch and bragged about some big special deal they were getting," one of the employees said. "What's the deal? Here these jokers had cheated the company, used the company computers, and now you're giving them half of a new company? Why are you rewarding them?" "Because it's good business," Al said. "Because these guys are good. They're going to make money for the company. We'll all be successful." No one was buying it. "Either the gamers go," they said, "or all 30 of them were going to quit." Al sighed deeply and walked back to the Gamers Edge office. "You guys went and told everyone about this and created a nightmare," he said. "Do you realize what you have done?" "Well," Carmack replied, "we wanted to be truthful." "Yeah, but I could have positioned it a lot better," he said. "I can't afford to lose my staff. The deal's off." After several weeks of negotiations and threatened lawsuits, it was agreed that they would contract with SoftDisk to write one new game for Gamer's Edge every 2 months. It was demoralizing, not only for the SoftDisk staff, but for Al. He saw that, despite their talent, the Gamer's Edge guys really were just boys living by their own rules and cheating when necessary. Worst of all, they had no sense of guilt. For them, it was something to laugh about. They never considered the people who worked at SoftDisk. Before Carmack left, Al pulled him aside and asked, "Did you ever think about the people who have worked so hard and supported you?" Carmack listened, but Al's words didn't compute. He was looking into the face of the past, of opportunities unrealized, of all the old authority figures who had ever stood in his way. As always, he was blunt to a fault. "I don't care about them," Al would recall Carmack replying. "I'll go back to making pizzas before I stay at this crummy place." On February 1st, 1991, id Software was born. Chapter 5. More Fun Than Real Life. Romero wanted to summon the demons, or at least, he said, figure out how. It was 4 a.m. at the lake house. Empty soda cans littered the floor. Mitzi dozed on top of Carmack's computer monitor. The smell of pepperoni lingered in the air. The guys sat around the large makeshift table in the living room, several hours into yet another round of Dungeons & Dragons. Since leaving SoftDisk, they had more time to devote to their recreational D&D campaign. It was truly evolving into an alternate world, which, like all fiction, deeply reflected their own. It wasn't just a game. It was an extension of their imaginations, hopes, dreams. It mattered. The deepness of their Dungeons & Dragons adventure was due in no small part to Carmack. Whereas most Dungeon Masters would create small episodes that lasted for a few hours of play, Carmack's world was persistent. Players returned to it every time they regrouped. The game they played now was the same one he had been writing since he was a kid in Kansas City. It was as if a musician had been composing an opera for several years, The guys would pass Carmack's room on the way to the bathroom in the middle of the night and see him hunched over pages of notes, sketching out the details of their game. Carmack's D&D world was a personal masterwork of forests and magic, time tunnels and monsters. He had a 50-page glossary of characters and items such as Quake, a fighter with a magical Hellgate cube floating above its head. The Chalice of Insanity, a chalice from which you get jelly beans of insanity, which, if ingested, will cause you to go nuts and fight everyone around you. And the mighty Daikatana sword. He relished the feeling of creating a place others could explore. The way D&D was played, he, as Dungeon Master, would invent and describe the set and setting. Then it was up to the players to dictate how they wanted to proceed. In their game, the guys created an imaginary group of adventurers called Popular Demand. Romero named his character Armand Hammer, a fighter who liked to dabble with magic. Tom was a fighter named Buddy. Jay, a thief acrobat named Riff. Adrian, a massive fighter named Stonebreaker. With each adventure, Popular Demand gained power and prestige. They were a living metaphor of id. As Carmack had said, the game had the power to bring out someone's true personality. And on this fateful night, Romero wanted to make a deal with the devil. In Carmack's game, he had designated two different dimensions of existence, a material plane, which Popular Demand inhabited, and a plane of demons. After months traversing the material plane, however, Romero was getting bored. To spice things up, he wanted to retrieve the dangerous and powerful Demonicron, a magic tome that gave a knowledgeable user the power to summon the demons to the material plane. Carmack consulted his D&D rulebook. If used thoughtfully, he told them, the Demonicron meant enormous strength to the group, guaranteeing them all the riches of the world. With it, Romero thought, he might get his hands on an ultimate weapon like the Daikatana. But there were risks. If the Demonicron fell into the hands of a demon, it would cause the world to be overrun with evil. Even though Carmack had made up the game, he respected its limitations, its rules, its science. If a player did something that would destroy the world, then the world would die. Romero and the rest discussed the options. Though Adrian and Tom were hesitant, Romero's excitement and enthusiasm won them over once again. Come on, he said, we can't lose. They decided to seize the Demonicron from its palace of supernatural beasts. Carmack rolled the die to determine the outcome of their battles. Popular Demand was victorious. The Demonicron was theirs. What they would do with it, they didn't know. For the time being, there were other matters at hand. In the earthly dimension, it was getting late, and there were other games to attend to. The ones by id Software. When the guys christened their company, they shortened the Ideas from the Deep initialism and simply called themselves id, for In Demand. They also didn't mind that, as Tom pointed out, id had another meaning, the part of the brain that behaves by the pleasure principle. In early 1991, their pleasurable games were indeed in demand. Keen was number one on the shareware charts, emerging as the first and only game to break the coveted top 10. The first Keen trilogy was now bringing in $15,000 to $20,000 per month. It wasn't just pizza money anymore. It was computer money. They used it to outfit the lake house with a fleet of high-end 386 PCs. Carmack was only 20 years old, Romero 23. And they were in business. Despite the success and the fact that Romero, Carmack, and Adrian had decided to leave Softdisk immediately that February, Tom and Jay chose to stay behind. In Tom's case, it was a temporary solution. Always conscientious, he felt bad about leaving the company high and dry and was more comfortable waiting until they found a replacement for him. Jay felt an obligation to fulfill his duty at Softdisk, which included the completion of an important Apple II product. But he would stay at least a friendly part of the id group, D&D campaign included, for some time. Heading into the spring of 1991, id rode on the high of its newfound freedom. Though under contractual obligation to Softdisk, they now could work on the games completely in the comfort of their lake house. Carmack immersed himself in programming what he wanted to be the next generation of his graphics engine. The first engine had enabled the primary breakthrough of side-scrolling action. Now, he wanted to create more elaborate and immersive effects. He methodically researched, while the rest utilized the existing technology to create their first freelance games for Softdisk. The freedom from Softdisk and the success of Keen were inspiring new kinds of games. Rescue Rover was about a young boy who had to rescue his dog, Rover, after the dog had been kidnapped by aliens. A clever maze game, it challenged the players to maneuver a series of mirrors to reflect deadly rays being cast by alien robots so the boy could find and save his dog. It combined what was emerging as something of an id formula: humor plus violence. The more over the top, the better. The title screen for Rescue Rover showed the slap-happy pooch with a wagging tail surrounded by sinister alien weapons aimed at his skull. While Rover took one step in the dark humor direction, their next game, which they began working on in March, Dangerous Dave in the Haunted Mansion, broke more sinister ground. For this one, Romero wanted to recast his most beloved character in a more gothic situation. Using the Keen graphics engine, they set about putting together a more realistic-looking Dave. This time, they wanted him to pull up to a wretched Shreveport-style house in a pickup truck, decked out in a hunting cap, jeans, and brandishing a shotgun, which he would use to rid the house of zombies and ghouls. Of all the id guys, Adrian was particularly juiced over the grisly theme. It was a chance for him to exercise all the gore he had seen when he worked at the hospital. Though he didn't tell the group, he still hated Commander Keen. If they were going to make a kids' game, he thought, they should be doing something gross and funny in the spirit of a popular TV series at the time, Ren and Stimpy. With Dangerous Dave in the Haunted Mansion, Adrian finally found an outlet. While Tom and Romero worked at their machines, Adrian, unbeknownst to them, began creating what he called death animations, three or four tiles that would play in rapid sequence after Dave died. In most games, characters would simply vanish, or, as Tom had instructed, Keen floated up the screen to heaven, presumably. Adrian had other ideas. Late one night, Romero hit a button and watched Adrian's animation play. Dave took a zombie fist to the face, which smashed out his eyes in a bloody pulp. Romero almost hyperventilated with laughter. "Blood!" he cackled. "In a game! How fucking awesome is that?" Violent fantasy, of course, had an ancient history. Readers had been fascinated by the gore of Beowulf for over 1,000 years. The demon clutched a sleeping thane in his swift assault, tore him in pieces, bit through the bones, gulped the blood, and gobbled the flesh. Kids played cops and robbers, brandishing their guns and flying backward in imagined bursts of blood. As the id guys came of age in the 1980s, the action movie genre, with films like Rambo, The Terminator, and Lethal Weapon, conquered the box office, just as horror movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Friday the 13th had done in the recent past. Violence in games was nothing new either. Even the very first computer game, Space War, was about destruction. But graphic violence certainly was. In the past, graphical violence was always limited, partly because of the inability of technology to render detail, and mainly because game developers avoided it. Back in 1976, an arcade game called Death Race had caused a ruckus. The object was to drive a car over a bunch of crudely drawn stick figure blips. When the player hit the screaming figures, they were replaced by crucifixes. The cabinet was painted with skulls and grim reapers. It was a far cry from the big hit of the day, Pong. It was also the first video game to be banned. Adrian's macabre work was too good to pass up. Fueled by Romero's enthusiasm, he added more and more gruesome details, including chunks of bloody flesh that would fly off a zombie's body when it was shot. When the guys at Softdisk saw the gore, however, they didn't get the joke and insisted that id redraw the death animations, sans blood. "Maybe one day," Adrian said, "we'll be able to put in as much blood as we want." While the other guys were pushing their envelopes, Carmack was pushing his own, specifically into 3D. Because he was a craftsman engineer, 3D was the obvious next step for him. Three-dimensional graphics were the holy grail for many programmers as well. To split hairs, the games weren't really three-dimensional in the 3D movie sense of the term. The term meant that graphics had a real sense of solid dimensions. Often these games were created from the first-person point of view. The whole idea was to make the player feel as if he were inside the game. Though Carmack was not aware of it, he was joining a pursuit that had begun thousands of years before. The dream of a realistic, immersive, interactive experience had consumed humankind for millennia. Some believed it to be a primal desire. Dating from 15,000 BCE, cave paintings in Lascaux in the south of France were considered to be among the first immersive environments, with images that would give the inhabitant the feeling of entering another world. In 1932, Aldous Huxley described a futuristic kind of movie experience called feelies in his novel Brave New World. Combining three-dimensional imagery as well as olfactory and tactile effects, the feelies, he wrote, were dazzling and incomparably more solid-looking than they would have seemed in actual flesh and blood, far more real than reality. Ray Bradbury imagined a similar experience in his 1950 short story, The Veldt, which presented, essentially, a view of the first virtual reality room. A family has a special room that can project any scene they imagine on the surrounding walls. Problems arise when an African vision becomes entirely too real. Soon technologists began efforts to realize these immersive environments. In 1955, the Hollywood cinematographer Morton Heilig described his work on The Cinema of the Future, which, he wrote, will far surpass the feelies of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. With a novelty machine called the Sensorama, which combined sights, sounds, and smells of urban landscapes, Heilig's aim was to create an illusion considerably more immersive than those of the tacky 3D movies of the time. The goal, he said, was a situation so lifelike that it gives the spectator the sensation of being physically in the scene. Convincing immersion was not just a matter of multimedia preening. It was a matter of interactivity, an essential ingredient and allure of computer games. Interactive immersive environments were the pet project of a University of Wisconsin computer artist named Myron Kruger. Throughout the 1970s, Kruger created Veldt-like experiences, sometimes achieved by projecting the images of audience members, even those in remote locations, on giant landscape screens. "The environments," he wrote, "suggest a new art medium based on a commitment to real-time interaction between men and machines. This context is an artificial reality within which the artist has complete control of the laws of cause and effect. Response is the medium." One such project, called Maze, let audience members try to navigate through an image of a maze that was projected in a room. By the 1980s, interactive immersions had taken on a new name, virtual reality. The author William Gibson coined the term cyberspace in his influential 1984 novel Neuromancer to describe an interactive online world that existed between computer networks. In the late 1980s, Scott Fisher, an engineer at the NASA Ames Research Center, combined a head-mounted display and data-transmitting hand gloves in what became the archetype of the virtual reality interface. Through these tools, users could enter a virtual world in which they could manipulate objects and proceed in a first-person, three-dimensional point of view. The end effect, Fisher wrote in 1989, is a kind of electronic persona. For interactive theater or interactive fantasy applications, these styles might range from fantasy figures to inanimate objects, or different figures to different people. Eventually, telecommunications networks may develop that will be configured with virtual environment servers for users to dial into remotely in order to interact with each other's virtual proxies. The possibilities of virtual realities, it appears, are as limitless as the possibilities of reality. They can provide a human interface that disappears as a doorway to other worlds. Carmack's research into 3D computer games was on a more intuitive level. Though he was a fan of science fiction, enamored of Star Trek's holodeck, his focus was not on chipping away at some grand design of such a virtual world, but rather on solving the immediate problem of the next technological advance. He had been experimenting with 3D graphics since making his wireframe MTV logos on his Apple II. Since then, several games had experimented with first-person 3D points of view. In 1980, Richard Garriott employed this perspective in his very first role-playing game, Akalabeth. 2 years later, an Apple II game from Sirius Software called Way Out wowed gamers and critics with a first-person maze game. But it was flight simulations, putting the player in the cockpits of a variety of airplanes, that exploited this kind of immersion. In 1990, Richard Garriott's company Origin released a space-themed combat flight simulator called Wing Commander, which became a favorite around the Id Lakehouse. Carmack figured he could do better. Flight sims, he thought, were painfully slow, bogged down by their heavy graphics and leaving the player to snail through the gameplay. What he and the others preferred was the fast action of arcade games like Defender, Asteroids, and Gauntlet. While the other guys worked on Rescue Rover and Dangerous Dave in the Haunted Mansion, Carmack tried to see how he might do something that hadn't been done before: create a fast action game in 3D. The problem, he found, was that the PC was not powerful enough to handle such a game. Carmack read up on the topic, but found nothing adequate for his solution. He approached the dilemma as he had in Keen: try the obvious approach first. If that fails, think outside the box. One of the reasons for a 3D game's slow speed was that the computer had to draw too many surfaces at once. Carmack had an idea. What if he commanded the computer to draw only a few surfaces at a time, the way one would put blinders on a horse? Rather than draw, in this case, arbitrary polygons, he designed a program that would draw only sideways trapezoids. In other words, walls, but no ceilings or floors. To get the computer to draw at the fastest possible speed, Carmack tried another non-traditional approach, known as ray casting. Instead of drawing out a large slab of graphics, which required a lot of memory and power, ray casting instructed the computer to paint a thin, vertical strip of graphics at a time, based on the player's point of view. The bottom line? Ray casting meant speed. Carmack's final challenge was to add characters in the 3D world. The solution was to incorporate simple though convincing graphical icons, or sprites. Wing Commander had used a calculation that told the computer to reduce or scale the size of the sprite depending on the player's location. By combining these so-called scaled sprites with his limited polygons and ray casting, Carmack was able to brew up a fast 3D world. Carmack emerged from his research after 6 weeks, 2 weeks longer than he had spent on any other game. When Romero saw the technology, he was once again impressed by the whiz kid. They discussed what kind of game could best exploit the new engine. They settled on a futuristic world in which the player, driving a tank, had to rescue people from nuclear Armageddon. Released in April 1991, Hover Tank was the first fast-action, first-person shooter for the computer. Id had invented a genre. Despite Hover Tank's innovations, it was no Commander Keen. The game looked rather ugly with its big, solid, colored walls, but it included Id's increasingly ghoulish touches. Adrian relished the chance to draw a cast of nuclear-mutated beasts reduced to puddles of blood. Like the Yorps and Keen, the puddles would linger through the game, so if a player returned to a spot, he would see the remnants of his carnage. As May began, id Software continued to innovate its games and expand its business, returning specifically to its first emerging brand, Commander Keen. To fulfill a game for soft disk, id decided to make a new episode called Keen Dreams. Though they had experimented with first-person 3D gaming in Hover Tank, they wanted to preserve Keen's side-scrolling integrity while adding something new. An obvious choice was to create a more compelling sense of moving through a landscape. For example, allowing the foreground and background to move at different speeds. This effect was known as parallax scrolling. In the past, a character might run past a static forest. In a parallax scrolling game, the trees would move very slowly while the character ran past. It seemed more real. Again, Carmack was faced with the limits of PC technology. After a few attempts, he realized that there was no way to create parallax scrolling in a convincing manner. Since the computers were too slow to draw a moving foreground and background, Carmack decided to fudge it. He wrote a program that could temporarily save or cache an image on the screen so that it didn't have to be redrawn every time a character passed by. To create the illusion of depth, he realized that he could temporarily save two images together, say, a little section of a sidewalk and a little chunk of a tree in the background for quick recall. Once again, he had pushed the graphics of the PC into a place no one had gone this quickly before. Keen Dreams was completed by the end of the month. In June 1991, id began work on the next trilogy of games for Scott Miller and Apogee. Keen 4, 5, and 6 would be released in the same manner as the first set. One initial chunk uploaded as shareware to tease players into purchasing the whole group. At this point, Apogee was comfortably ruling not just the shareware gaming world, but the entire shareware world. The Keen games were at the top of the charts, bringing in close to $60,000 per month. If they followed the same plan, Scott assured them, they would earn at least as much. Tom wrote the storyline of this trilogy, Goodbye Galaxy. This time around, Commander Keen discovers a plot to blow up the galaxy and must head off in his Bean with Bacon mega rocket to save the world. First, he has to tend to his parents, whom he temporarily immobilized with a stun gun. The stun gun was a new and necessary addition to the game, Tom thought. After the first Keen trilogy, Tom began opening letters of complaint from concerned parents who didn't like the dead Yorps corpses hanging around on screen. Why couldn't the characters just disappear when they die, like in most games? Tom still wanted kids to see the effects of their violence, but he didn't want to stir up unnecessary controversy. He decided that, beginning with this game, the creatures would simply be stunned when hit. They wouldn't die. They would just remain frozen, circles of stars surrounding their heads. By August, id had a working prototype, or beta, of Commander Keen 4, Secret of the Oracle. At the time, Romero had met a smooth-talking gamer in Canada named Mark Rain. Mark had been a big fan of the first Keens and asked Romero if they needed anyone to playtest their next games. Romero said they did and sent Mark a beta of Keen 4. At the end was a teaser description of the next episode, The Armageddon Machine, which promised the game would be, among other things, more fun than real life. Mark replied with a detailed list of bugs, impressing Romero. Mark wasn't just a gamer. He was an aspiring businessman who was so sure he could get id some deals that he offered to fly himself down to Shreveport to meet with the guys. Romero, from the moment he saw the Dangerous Dave and copyright infringement demo, had been looking for ways to expand the business. Maybe Mark could fill that void. Carmack was making this great technology, after all, so why not have someone in the company who would exploit it for all it was worth? Carmack didn't jump at the suggestion. As he was fond of pointing out, he wasn't interested in running a big company. He just wanted to program games. But he recognized that, without Romero, id wouldn't have been in the business in the first place. He agreed to bring Mark Rain on as id's probationary president for 6 months. Within weeks, Mark had scored a deal to release a retail version of Commander Keen with a company called FormGen. He raved about the opportunity for id to cash in on the commercial marketplace. They were going to make three games anyway. All they had to do was take one of them and release it with FormGen as retail. For id, it seemed like a great idea, a second way to cash in. They could release one Keen in the shareware market and another in retail. Id had no contract with Apogee, but they called Scott Miller to tell him of the opportunity. Their relationship was going well. Earlier in the summer, Scott had brought a coterie of game developers to visit at the boys' invitation. Romero had decided to host a seminar to encourage other game developers to license id's technology. Licensing made sense, Romero thought, because Carmack's technology was clearly so impressive. Why not let others pay to use it themselves? Over a weekend, the id guys showed how the Keen engine could be used by creating an impromptu PC version of Pac-Man that they dubbed Whack-Man. They completed it in a night and sold their first license to Apogee. When the id guys told Scott later about the FormGen opportunity, he was dismayed. "This is a big problem," he said to them. "You're breaking the magic formula of the trilogy. If you release a shareware game and don't let people buy the full trilogy, it's not going to sell as well." "It's too late," they told him. They had already signed the deal. By August 1991, id Software's growing ambitions were leading them not only into new business, new games, and new technologies, but to a new home. Tom and Romero wanted out of Shreveport. Despite the fun days at the lake house, they were getting tired of the depressing environment. Romero hated driving past all the poor people fishing for food off the Cross Lake Bridge. He had another motivation, too. A girlfriend, Beth McCall. Beth worked at Soft Disk in the shipping department. A former debutante from New Orleans, she was bright and cheerful and laughed at all Romero's silly jokes. The relationship was light and fun, just the tonic Romero felt he needed after his divorce. Though his relationship with his ex-wife was strained, he still felt close to his sons. With Beth, he was able to fill a void. Best of all, she wanted out of Shreveport, too. Tom had an idea where to go. He missed the change of the seasons and culture of his college town and begged them to relocate to Wisconsin. Romero agreed to accompany Tom to check out Madison, a college town. They returned convinced that this was the place to go. Their other lake house roommate, Jason Blachowiak, had gone to school in Madison and quickly offered to leave Soft Disk and come along. The other guys didn't think Jason was quite motivated enough. He had once commented how he made more money from his investments than from his computer programming. He drove a van with a vanity license plate that read, Autocrat. But Carmack thought he was a smart, talented programmer and was happy to have him. Carmack was fine with going to Madison. As he often told the others, he didn't care where he was as long as he could code. Adrian was much more reluctant. Shreveport, after all, was his lifelong home. Though he explored dark worlds in his art, in real life, he craved stability. Romero begged and pleaded, promising Adrian that their apartments would be only the best. After much convincing from his friends and family, Adrian agreed to go. Jay, however, to everyone's disappointment, was not on board for this ride. Feeling obliged to complete his projects at SoftDisk and leery of risking a startup venture, he chose to stay behind. On a warm morning in September, the id guys loaded up their cars and drove away from the lake house one last time. The computers in their trunks were their own. Chapter 6. Green and Pissed. For once, reality didn't live up to Romero's hype. The id guys arrived at the apartment in Madison on a gray day in September 1991 to find it considerably less fun than he and Tom had described. They were in a sprawling complex in which every building looked the same. Compared with their Shreveport house, it was a dump. No lake, no yard, no boat. When they walked down the hall, they didn't pass trees. They passed two scary-looking guys dealing drugs. At least they had some semblance of an id office, a three-bedroom apartment in the complex. Because Carmack didn't care, he agreed to live in the upstairs bedroom, while all the other guys got their own apartments elsewhere in the complex. Adrian, who was instantly miserable being out of his element, had even more problems because his apartment was on the far side of the development. While the other guys walked across a parking lot to get to the id office, Adrian had to drive. But Romero was delighted. He was starting fresh. He had a new girlfriend and new games. Tom shared in the enthusiasm, happy to be back home, refreshed by the collegiate environment. The only real sore point for the two of them was Jason, who had become Carmack's friend. He seemed to be on a completely different wavelength. Still, Carmack wasn't ready to let him go. Despite their mixed feelings about their new situation, the id team buckled down to finish the second Commander Keen trilogy. After their long months working together, the team had formed into a collective personality. Romero and Carmack were now in a perfect groove, with Carmack improving the new Keen engine, the code that made the graphics, while Romero worked on the editor and tools, the software used to create the game elements. Nothing could distract them. One night, Beth and a few other women showed up at the apartment. The guys were hard at work. Beth did her best to attract Romero's attention. When nothing elicited a response, she threw up her hands and said, "Why can't we just have our men come home and have sex with us?" "Because we're working," Romero said. Carmack laughed. Tom was just as dedicated, feeling particularly giddy about the success of the project, which inspired him to new heights of creative design. He populated Keen's world with gun-toting potato men, tongue-wagging poisonous mushrooms, and his favorite, the dope fish, a green fish with big dopey eyes and giant front teeth. Adrian, as usual, didn't share Tom's glee, but he put all his efforts into bringing the silly characters to life. His artwork was taking on more color and precision, rivaling that of the best games on the market. He was also finding a way to vent his mounting frustrations with Tom, Keen, and Madison. One time he played around with the Commander Keen image, creating a graphic of Keen with his eyes gouged out and his throat ripped open. Adrian had a good laugh switching between the images of Keen all happy and chipper and Keen sliced and diced. With the work on the new Keynes progressing and checks continuing to pour in, Carmack was able to go back to his pet project, 3D first-person shooters. The latest step was inspired by something he had heard from Romero. Carmack and Romero had developed another aspect of their collaboration. Though Carmack was gifted at creating game graphics, he had little interest in keeping up with the gaming world. He was never a player, really. He only made the games, just as he was the dungeon master, but not a player of D&D. Romero, by contrast, kept up with everything, all the new games and developers. It was through one of these developers that he first learned about an important new development called texture mapping. Texture mapping meant applying a detailed pattern or texture to a tile of graphics on the computer screen. Instead of drawing a solid color on the back wall of a game, the computer would draw a pattern of bricks. Romero heard about texture mapping from Paul Neurath, whose company, Blue Sky Productions, was working on a game called Ultima Underworld, which would be published by Richard Garriott's Origin Company. Neurath told Romero that they were applying texture mapping to shapes or polygons in a three-dimensional world. Cool, Romero thought. When he hung up the phone, he spun his chair to Carmack and said, Paul said he's doing a game using texture mapping. Texture mapping? Carmack replied, then took a few seconds to spin the concept around in his head. I can do that. The result was Catacomb 3D, which incorporated texture-mapped walls of gray bricks covered in green slime. To play, the gamer ran through the maze, shooting fireballs out of a hand that was drawn in the lower center of the screen, as if one was looking down on one's own arm, reaching into the computer. By including the hand, id Software was making a subtle but strong point to its audience. You are not just playing the game, you're inhabiting it. The game ended up being published 6 months before Neurath's Ultima Underworld. Though Ultima Underworld, a role-playing adventure, received more attention because of the Garriott connection, together, the games took the 3D gaming experience to a new, more immersive place. When Scott Miller saw Catacomb 3D, he had one thing to say. We need to do something like this as shareware. As Thanksgiving 1991 neared, life in Madison was turning increasingly ugly. The drug-dealing neighbors had been arrested after the cops pounded down their door. Someone siphoned gasoline from their cars. Adrian was particularly miserable because he lost the cap to his waterbed and couldn't find a replacement. He spent months in a sleeping bag on the floor. Carmack had been sleeping on the floor for months too, though by choice. He simply didn't feel he needed a mattress. Finally, Romero got fed up with the situation and bought his partner a mattress, leaving it for him on his floor. Dude, he said, it's time you got a good night's sleep. Madison was growing cold. Really, really cold. Snow dumped from the sky. The entire parking lot of the complex was glazed over in ice. Every afternoon when he'd wake up, Adrian would have to sit in his car for 20 minutes, warming the engine so he could drive to the other side of the development. One time, they all went out to buy a pizza, but ran back to their cars without the pie. They were so cold, they decided to leave the pizza and drive home. No one was willing to run back inside. The result was that they barely left their apartment. Though they were used to spending endless hours together in a small room, in Shreveport at least they had the opportunity to go outside and kneeboard around the lake. Here, they killed even more time playing Dungeons and Dragons. In an effort to expand the game, they even drew up flyers that they posted around town. At the top of the page, Adrian had drawn each of the id guys as his character in the game. Tom with a beard and a large axe, Romero with a huge sword, Adrian standing high with a belt that had the word die on a cloth, and Carmack dressed as a wizard holding the rule book. Next to them was a blank stick figure with a question mark for a head. The flyer read, "Wanted, cleric and or thief. Party playing in an awesome, character and event-driven campaign. Just moved our business here. Need one or two new players. Things you will enjoy in this campaign. Character interaction. Good balance. Cool stuff happening. Pizza. Things you won't be doing in this campaign. Dominating the world." Tensions began to rise, however, about who was trying to dominate the apartment. Adrian was fed up with Tom and Romero bopping around, making alien noises, and imitating the characters from Keen. Even Carmack was growing tired of their antics. Worse was the trouble with Jason, who was becoming something of a fifth wheel. Carmack was still defending him, though, so instead of firing him, they assigned him to bang out a fast, easy game by himself that could fulfill an obligation on the soft disk contract. With the soft disk game being handled by Jason and the second Keen trilogy wrapping up, id could focus on its next project for Apogee. At this point, a hierarchy had been established. Carmack was the technology leader, coming up with the latest engines with which they could construct a game. Tom, as creative director, was in charge of spearheading the game stuff that would go around Carmack's technology. Romero fit nicely between the two, able to help Carmack with tools and at the same time goof around with Tom on creative ideas. Adrian would fulfill their orders for artwork, injecting, when he could, his own menacing visions. When the four sat down late one night to discuss a new game, those roles unexpectedly began to shift. The trouble started with Tom. Buoyed by the blockbuster success of the first trilogy months before, he had long imagined doing three trilogies, similar to the plan his hero George Lucas had mapped out for the Star Wars films. But Carmack's technology was clearly headed toward another idea, a fast-action, first-person game. Keen was neither fast action nor first person. It was a side-scrolling adventure like Mario. It was implicit that the next game, at least, would call for something else. Tom was disappointed, but he shifted into high gear, brainstorming for a new first-person game. He had an immediate idea. "Hey," he said, "remember in the movie The Thing when the guy comes out of the cage where the dogs are going insane from that alien and everyone asks him what's in there? And he says, 'I don't know, but it's weird and pissed off.' Well, that's just like a video game. Because in video games, you have no idea why you're shooting the monsters other than that they're green and pissed off. Why not do a game like that? Something about these mutant lab experiments you have to hunt down." He started jotting down potential titles at his PC as he read them aloud to the group. "Mutants from Hell. Die, mutants, die. Three Demons. Texture Map Terrence and the Green Shits." Or, he concluded, they could just cut to the chase and call the game "It's Green and Pissed." Everyone laughed. "Yeah," Romero said. "Imagine some game dude wandering into a computer store and saying to the clerk, 'Excuse me, but do you have It's Green and Pissed?'" Despite their approval, Tom quickly retreated from his idea. He didn't want to be controversial for controversy's sake. "Yeah, I don't know," Romero said. "That's so hackneyed. That's something you always hear of. It's like, 'Yet again, the mutated lab full of bullshit, blah, blah, blah. We need to do something cool.' You know, it'd be really fucking cool if we made a remake of Castle Wolfenstein and did it in 3D. Wolfenstein. It was a word that struck an immediate chord with both Carmack and Tom, who, like Romero and every other hardcore Apple II gamer, had grown up playing the classic action title created by the legendary Silas Warner in the early 1980s. They immediately got Romero's vision. Wolfenstein was perfect for Carmack's technology because it was, at its core, a maze-based shooter. The player had to run through all these labyrinths, fighting Nazis and collecting treasure, then doing away with Hitler. Despite the game's blocky, low-resolution graphics, it was unique in its implication of a larger virtual world. When Castle Wolfenstein was released, most games for computers or arcades, like Pong, existed on one static screen. But in Wolfenstein, the conceit was that each screen the player saw represented one room of a large castle. Each room was a maze of walls. When the player ran through the maze, the screen would change, showing a new room. Though there was no scrolling, the feeling was one of true exploration. Part of the appeal was that the player never knew what awaited in the next room. Often, it was a Nazi screaming in German. Encouraged by everyone's sympathetic reaction, Romero exploded with ideas. In the original Wolfenstein, the characters could search the bodies of dead soldiers. How cool would that be to have in first-person 3D? He said. You could go through and, like, drag the bodies around a corner and rifle through their pockets. He said, imitating the sounds. We have this opportunity to do something totally new here. Something fast and texture mapped. If we can make the graphics look great and fast and make the sound cool and loud and make the game explosively fun, then we're going to have a winner, especially with the theme. The computer game industry was still meek, after all. SimCity, a hit game, challenged players to build and micromanage a virtual town. Civilization, another success, was a heady, risk-like strategy game based on famous historical battles, blood not included. Wolfenstein could be like nothing the industry had ever seen. It will be just shocking, Romero concluded, a totally shocking game. Carmack gave his blessing. Once behind an idea, Romero was always charismatically convincing, and Carmack was growing to appreciate Romero's talent for taking his technology into a new world, a place he himself would never have conceived. Adrian, who wasn't familiar with the original Wolfenstein, was eager to do anything other than keen, and the idea of 3D art intrigued him. Tom, though stung by the rejection of Keen, assumed that they would return to his games after this one. He was still the company's game designer, after all. So, true to his conciliatory nature, he was willing to go along for the ride. It was a ride all the more immersive because of Carmack's technology, and all the more wild because, for the first time in id's brief history, it was being steered by Romero. On a cold winter day, Carmack laced up his shoes, slipped on his jacket, and headed out into the Madison snow. The town was blanketed in the stuff, cars caked in frost, trees dangling ice. Carmack endured the chill because he had no car. He'd sold the MGB long before. It was easy enough for him to shut out the weather, just like he could, when necessary, shut Tom and Romero's antics out of his mind. He was on a mission. Carmack stepped into the local bank and requested a cashier's check for $11,000. The money was for a Next computer, the latest machine from Steve Jobs, co-creator of Apple. The Next, a stealth black cube, surpassed the promise of Jobs' earlier machines by incorporating NextStep, a powerful system tailor-made for custom software development. The market for PCs and games was exploding, and this was the perfect tool to create more dynamic titles for the increasingly viable gaming platform. It was the ultimate Christmas present for the ultimate in young graphics programmers, Carmack. The Next computer wasn't the only new spirit ushering in the new year. Times were changing in the world of id. They had finally fired Jason, narrowing the group to Carmack, Romero, Adrian, and Tom. But something else was in the air. The Reagan-Bush era was finally coming to a close, and a new spirit rising. It began in Seattle, where a sloppily dressed grunge rock trio called Nirvana ousted Michael Jackson from the top of the pop charts with their album Nevermind. Soon, grunge and hip-hop were dominating the world with more brutal and honest views. Id was braced to do for Games what those artists had done for music, overthrow the status quo. Games until this point had been ruled by their own equivalent of pop in the form of Mario and Pac-Man. Unlike music, the software industry had never experienced anything as rebellious as Wolfenstein 3D. The title came after much brainstorming. At first, they assumed they had to use something other than the Wolfenstein name, which had been created by Silas Warner at Muse Software. Tom banged out a list of options from The Strained, the Fourth Reich, or Deep in Germany, to The Absurd, Castle Hasselhoff, or Luger Me Now. He even played around with some German titles. Dolch Teufel, Devil Dagger, Geruchschlecht, Bad Smell. To their surprise and relief, they discovered that Muse had gone bankrupt in the mid-1980s and let the trademark on the Wolfenstein name lapse. It would be Wolfenstein 3D. When they ran the idea by Scott, he loved it. He had been pleading with them to do a 3D shareware game for months. He, too, knew Castle Wolfenstein and cracked up at Romero's plans for their version. Loud guns, fast action, mowing down Nazis. Money was still rolling in from the Keen games. The second trilogy was out in the shareware market, too. Its numbers were disappointing, about a third of the original, but Scott knew this was not so much a sign of the game's appeal as verification of his original concern, that the retail release of a Keen game for FormGen would cut into his sales because it left him with only two episodes, not three. Nevertheless, the guys at Id were his stars, and he believed wholeheartedly in their technology and vision. He guaranteed them $100,000 for Wolfenstein. Id had no intentions to stop there. Mark Rain, still Id's probationary president, had scored with FormGen to release two more retail Id products. Id was excited, but concerned. FormGen's first game with them, Commander Keen, Aliens Ate My Babysitter, didn't sell well. Id blamed in part what they thought was a terrible box cover, designed by a company that had done packages for Lipton Tea. But the prospect for another shot was enticing. Again, it would allow them to earn revenues from two lucrative markets, shareware and retail. No one, not even Origin and Sierra, was doing this. Though Mark and FormGen were reluctant to, as they said, stir up the World War II stuff, they agreed to take Wolfenstein retail. The Id guys were growing accustomed to getting their way. Mitzi enjoyed her new perch atop Carmack's spacious black Next computer. She stretched out lazily on the monitor, letting her legs dangle over the screen. Surrounded by empty pizza boxes and Diet Coke cans, Romero, Carmack, Tom, and Adrian sat at their computers, working on Wolfenstein 3D. The calmness of the outer world was in stark contrast to the world unfolding on the screens. Wolfenstein had taken on two imperatives. It would be brutal, as originally imagined by Romero, and it would be fast, as engineered by Carmack. Carmack knew he could up the speed, and thus the immersion, thanks to the leaps he had made by combining ray casting with texture mapping on Catacomb 3D. For Wolfenstein, he didn't so much take another leap as improve his existing code, cleaning up the bugs, optimizing the speed, making it more elegant. A key decision was to let the graphics engine focus on drawing only what the player needed to see. That meant, once again, drawing the walls, but not the ceilings and floors. Also, to speed things up, characters and objects in the game would not be in true 3D. They would be sprites, flat images, that, if encountered in real life, would look like cardboard cutouts. Romero, in pure Melvin mode, imagined all the crazy stuff they could do in a game where the object was, as he said, to mow down Nazis. He wanted to have the suspense of an Apple II game, pumped up with the shock and horror of storming a Nazi bunker. There would be SS soldiers and Hitler. Adrian hit the history books, scanning images of the German leader to include throughout the game. But that wasn't enough. "How about," Romero suggested, "we throw in guard dogs, dogs that you can shoot, fucking German shepherds." Adrian cracked up, sketching out a dog that, in a death animation, could yelp back. "And there should be blood," Romero said. "Lots of blood, blood like you never see in games. And the weapons should be lethal, but simple. A knife, a pistol, maybe a Gatling gun, too." Adrian sketched as Romero spoke. Tom came up with ideas for objects the players could collect through the game. In a paradigm dating back to the early text-based adventures, the gamer had two essential missions: to collect and to kill. Tom came up with treasures and crosses for players to find. There was also the issue of health items. A player would begin with his health at 100%. With every shot, the health would decrease until, when it hit 0%, the player would die. To survive, a player could pick up so-called health items. Tom wanted these items to be funny. He said, "Why not turkey dinners?" "Yeah," Romero agreed. "Or even better, how about dog food? They were having German shepherds in the game, so what the hell?" Tom began cackling at the thought of a player slurping up dog food. "Or how about this?" Tom added. "When the player gets really low on health, at like 10%, he could run over the bloody guts of a dead Nazi soldier and suck those up for extra energy." "Flip, slurp," Romero said, making the sounds and wiping his chin while cracking up. "It's like human giblets. You can eat up their jibs." The work would go late into the night. Carmack and Romero perfectly embodied the two extremes. While Carmack tweaked his code, Romero experimented with the graphics and new ways to exploit the tools. Carmack was building the guitar that Romero would bring to life. But their friendship was not traditional. They didn't discuss their lives, their hopes, their dreams. Sometimes, late at night, they would sit side by side, playing a hovercraft racing game called F-Zero. For the most part, though, their friendship was in their work, their unbridled pursuit of the game. Carmack and Romero shared a vision the others didn't possess. Tom, deep down, was still closer to Keane, concerned about violence, about being too controversial, too bloody. Adrian liked the gore. He sketched out dead Nazis lying in pools of blood, but he still harbored a desire to get back to something more gothic and horrific, like Dangerous Dave in the Haunted Mansion. Carmack and Romero, however, were in sync. Carmack didn't so much care about the accoutrements of the game as he enjoyed Romero's passion for showing off what his engine could do. Romero got what he was doing, trying to make a sleek, simple, fast game engine. And he was the one who dreamed up the sleek, simple, fast game to go around it. Romero even began excising parts of the game just to adhere to that dictum. At first, they had programmed the game so that players could drag and search dead Nazis, as in the original Castle Wolfenstein. But they didn't like the outcome. "Ugh," Romero groaned as he watched Tom drag a body across.